This is Radio Eco Shop with your host, Alex Smith.
The media talks about dead zones in the ocean. Scientists prefer oxygen minimum zone. Whatever we call them, these large areas seem dead to life as we know it, and they're increasing around the world. Is the ocean dying? And what is the climate connection? There are questions and deep changes we all need to grasp. To sort it out, we have the lead author of a paper published December 2019 about dark carbon fixation. Dr. Sabine K. Lenger is a lecturer in chemistry at the School of Geography, Earth and Environmental Science at the University of Plymouth, UK. From Plymouth, Sabine Lenger, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi.
Hi. So the plain language summary for your new paper says, quote, "With global warming and increased nutrients from rivers, dead zones are forecast to expand." Sabine, why are dead zones going to expand with global warming?
That's a very complex question, actually. Basically, there's many things that contribute to dead zones, and some of these dead zones are natural, but they basically describe areas without oxygen. So things that increase the number of dead zones and the extent of dead zones is, for example, the presence of a lot of nutrients, increased nutrients running off from agricultural environments into the ocean, for example. They help to increase the number and areas of dead zones, really. At the same time, increased rainfall events, for example, can help soil erosion, and those transport even more soil and nutrients into the ocean. And this increased rainfall, for example, is linked to global warming. But then there's also other more direct influences. So the solubility of oxygen is affected by temperature, so there'll be less oxygen in the ocean if the oxygen gets warmer. And also, many natural dead zones are created through upwelling. So that means that nutrient-rich water from the deep ocean is being transported to the surface ocean due to kind of winds driving away the water from the surface ocean. And that will also change with global warming. Global warming can have an effect on that. And the last thing is that is stratification. So basically, I don't know if you know, but there's a gradient, the depth gradient of different chemicals or oxygen throughout the water has often a sharp boundary. And this is called stratification. So basically, for example, you have a very thin oxygen-rich layer on the top, and then there's a very sharp decline to an oxygen-free zone. And this stratification is also forecast to increase with global warming. So it's a complex question, and there's lots of things that feed into that. But most of the global warming effects will kind of lead to an increase in dead zones.
And the model we have for dead zones set up in the public mind requires that excess fertilization of algae from farm runoff and or human waste or some shore-based trigger. Is that the only cause of dead zones?
No, they're absolutely not. So there's coastal dead zones, and then there's open ocean dead zones. And a lot of the coastal dead zones, and for example, the Gulf of Mexico dead zones, is mostly created by this increased runoff. These are specifically dead zones that have been created by humans. And another example is the Baltic Sea. So the Baltic Sea has a vast dead zone, and that's linked to human activity. But then there's other places in the world, like the Black Sea or the Arabian Sea, where my study was based, but also some areas in the tropical north and tropical south Pacific, which are just natural dead zones, and they are created by other effects, natural effects. And in these ocean zones, it's upwelling, so basically the transport of nutrient-rich waters from the bottom of the oceans to the surface, kind of fueling the phytoplankton through that.
The International Union for Conservation of Nature, or IUCN, recently published a report on ocean dead zones. It was pretty scary. They said observed dead zones rose from about 50 in the 1960s to over 700 today. Sabine, to your knowledge, is there a ceiling for dead zones, a limit to how far they might spread?
So in the geological past, we have some events which we call as oceanic anoxic events. And some people argue that these have been global events and the whole global ocean. And some people argue that these only affected restricted basins or certain places. So I cannot really tell you whether there is a ceiling, but there are some people that argue that in the past, the whole ocean or most of the ocean was anoxic. And those events are usually connected to mass extinctions. So that was kind of when a lot of species just disappeared from the fossil record, changed shape, tried to adapt. So I wouldn't say there's necessarily a ceiling, because we have had events in the past where it seems to have been quite global. What's really important to note as well is that in these global or in these past oceanic anoxic events, if these were global, then even then this anoxia has developed over 10,000 and more of years, really. So what we have here now is we have this developing within only about 100 years or 100, 200 years. It's a very quick rise in CO2 concentrations. It's a very quick depletion of the ocean of oxygen in comparison to the geological past. So, yeah, I don't think we've had in the geological past an event that was such an instantaneous CO2 spike, because 100 years in geological timescales is instantaneous, really. You can't even resolve that probably in most records. Yeah, I wouldn't say there's necessarily a ceiling, but let's hope there is.
Have scientists seen dead zones increasing in size? I mean, how worried should we be about this, Sabine?
I think this is actually really worrisome, and the International Union for Conservation of Nature has published this report, and it is a very worrying report. I'm really glad that this has happened, because I think dead zones, well, for years I have, because I've worked on dead zones for about 10 years now, and I've always thought that dead zones are really disregarded, because they have a huge economic effects. They have health effects, because at the same time when productivity rises, you often increase the amount of toxic algae, which then seep into the toxins, then seep into the shellfish. So you create a lot of kind of toxic shellfish as well. You have economic effects in terms of fisheries. You have effects on tourism. So if you have a dead zone and you have dead fish washing up and stuff, then it's even if it's close to a dead zone and you start to kind of like, if hydrogen sulfide evolves, for example, it's not particularly for tourists a very attractive place to go. But also for fisheries, this is a huge problem. And people are seeing this in the Gulf of Mexico, because there's areas where they cannot fish and when the seasonal dead zone evolves, because they won't find any fish. And if they fish at the edges of the dead zone or the oxygen minimum zone, what you find is that you find a lot of fish because they're congregating there, because they cannot really go anywhere else. And you fish in this density, in these high-density fish regions, and you have lots of very small fish that are being fished. And obviously, fishing very small specimens is really bad for fish populations, because it means you don't give them the time to grow to proper size and to reproduce. So it has a huge effect on fisheries, a very negative effect. In general, it could have an effect on the whole number of species that live in areas where dead zones are developing.
Sabine Lenker, how did you get drawn into the study of these tiny bacteria and dead zones?
When I did my PhD about 10 years ago, we went on a cruise in the Arabian Sea, and we were studying these dead zones from farm and organic biogeochemists. So we were looking at basically organic chemicals. I look at organic chemicals in the environment, and I try to find out what's going on in the environment in terms of the microbes in the present and in the past, and also the health of the environment. So that's basically what I do. But so we were going to look at all these different organic molecules that were present in the Arabian Sea sediments within the dead zone and below the dead zone. And we're going to see how they were different, and we're going to kind of do a whole geochemical study. And that's what we did as well. But we just noticed a very specific signature of this sediment, this 13C signature. And we've spent like years trying to explain it until we kind of figured out that it was probably the contribution of chemoautotrophs, so dark carbon-fixing organisms, that was creating this very weird signature. And that's kind of how I started really working on the topic of different contributions and the biogeochemical cycle like within the water column of the dead zone.
Are there still dead zones off the west coast of North America?
Yes, there are. So the eastern tropical North Pacific has a dead zone. That's a natural dead zone caused by upwelling. So the same process that brings the cold water to the west coast of North America is the same process that brings nutrients to the surface and that causes the phytoplankton to grow very well there, and that creates a dead zone.
So there are regions where we are more likely to have dead zones, and certainly near the coasts where humans are putting off a lot of fertilizers. There must also be parts of the ocean where we're very unlikely to find dead zones that are sort of self-protected against this phenomenon, would you say?
Yeah, that's right. Obviously, where the circulation is quite open and it's very difficult to get stratification, that's less likely. So, for example, the Southern Ocean is productive, but there's no dead zones in the Southern Ocean at the moment. What's often causing this dead zone as well is the stratification. So that means if you really heat the upper bit of the water, then you get very cold water just straight below, so you get a sharp drop, and that kind of like increases the stratification as well. And that's obviously less likely in areas like, for example, the Southern Ocean. I wouldn't say they're self-protected because, I mean, in the Eocene, we have some evidence that the Arctic was overgrown with freshwater algae and these very organic rich sediments that were deposited there. And so if CO2 is high and temperatures are high, then ocean circulation changes and can create very different environments in the future.
Well, this whole field is so scientifically young. Obviously, we need more research. So to get a grip on this, I think it's time to introduce some new little friends in the sea. What are anammox bacteria, and why did we only find out about them in the 1990s?
That's a really good question. And anammox bacteria were discovered. They were discovered in wastewater reactors, and we absolutely did not know that they were there or that they could do this. But there has been a hypothesis that it is possible to oxidize ammonia anaerobically for a while before that, and it just very difficult to culture all these different organisms and to find out what they're doing. It's a lot of work. You have to be a little bit lucky, but you also have to be very, very good microbiologists to find out. So anammox bacteria, they are bacteria that live. There's different types, and one type lives in wastewater reactors and one type lives in the ocean. And what's special about them is that they take ammonia and they convert it into oxidized species, and finally they release it as nitrogen gas, so they create deep nitrogen gas. But at the same time, they fix CO2, they fix carbon, so they're not a bacteria that eats organic matter, they create organic matter from inorganic carbon.
Wow, it sounds almost like an alien form of life that we've discovered in the sea. So when they capture carbon dioxide, which I gather would be deposited on the sea bottom when these tiny lives die and drop down, is that similar to the capture of carbon dioxide that algae can do further up in the light zone?
Yes, that's right. So the biochemical pathway is a different one than the one that algae would be using. But in principle, the principle is the same. So they take carbon dioxide and they convert that into organic matter. It's just that they don't need to use light for that. They get all their energy from inorganic chemicals. And that's why they're called chemoautotrophs. So there's photoautotrophs, and photo means they use light to fix CO2. And then there's chemoautotrophs, and chemo means they use chemicals to fix CO2.
And of course, deeper in the ocean, there just isn't any light.
That's right. There's no light at the place where they operate.
What did you test in the Arabian Sea, and why there?
Basically, the Arabian Sea is quite an interesting environment, and what we tested was, what we really wanted to look at is, we had a signature of organic carbon deposited at the bottom of the ocean, and we used the 13C signature of it. So 13C is an isotope of carbon, so most of the carbon in the world is 12C, about 98.9% in the world is 12C. But about 1.1% is 13C, so that it means it has an extra neutron, so it's a little bit heavier. This 1.1% means it's 1.1 in general, but actually it varies a little bit. And depending on the type of life form that has converted CO2 into organic matter, it'll be related to that. So, for example, one type of life form will have 1.111%, and the other one will have 1.112%, for example. So that is quite a characteristic marker for who's been doing the fixing of the carbon. So we saw a signature of sediments that was deposited in the oxygen minimum zone that had this typical carbon signature that is related to Anamox. It had a lot less 13C than it would have had had it been fixed by phytoplankton. And we used that, and we used a specific biomarker for Anamox bacteria, so a compound, a chemical that is only produced by Anamox bacteria, in order to find out how much Anamox bacteria are actually contributing to the sedimentary organic matter. And we found out that it could be quite a significant amount.
And you say this newly discovered type of bacteria can live at the edge or in the middle of these dead zones. So the dead zones are not really quite dead.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah, and I think that's the point that I wanted to really bring across. I mean, microbiologists know that these dead zones are not dead, but I think the amount of carbon that is being fixed and converted into organic matter in these dead zones has been underestimated. And at the moment, it is really only just considered that all the carbon that is present in this dead zone and below is coming from the top of the ocean, because that's where the bulk of carbon fixation happens in the photic zone. But actually, there's quite a lot of this is also going on lower down in the dark parts of the ocean. And people call them dead zones, but that's because there's no life as we know it. So there's no life that we can see, really. The only life that is there is pretty much microscopic. So there's very little in terms of multicellular organisms to find there. And there's no fish, for example. So fish will swim away if they're lucky. And if a dead zone is developing, and there won't be any fish. So they call it dead zones, I suppose, after, because if a fisherman casts a net in this dead zone, then it'll come back empty because there won't be anything in there.
So this could be good news, because it says there is some carbon fixation and sequestration even in dead zones. But reading the paper, I'm not clear how much these bacteria can sequester carbon, say, compared to algae growing in the sunlight closer to the surface. How do they compare?
And if you take, for example, a square meter of the surface ocean, and then a square meter of the surface ocean in the very, very productive areas can fix about maybe 300 grams of carbon per square meter per year. But if you take a look at the Anamox bacteria, for example, the way I determined it, this would only be much less than that. So it would be maybe 3 grams or even less. So it would only be 1% of carbon fixed compared to the surface ocean. And actually what is happening there is that organic matter that is down in the dark ocean actually fuels other processes that lead to nitrogen loss in the ocean. And also, Anamox bacteria, they produce some greenhouse gases, so there's also greenhouse gas production going on. So all in all, whilst this is fixing CO2, it's not actually like a good carbon sequestration mechanism, if that makes sense. And the organic matter that's actually present there in this dark ocean is adding to heterotrophic processes, so processes that consume organic matter and consume oxygen, and that leads to an expansion of the oxygen minimum zone. But in general, you're right, oxygen minimum zones or dead zones in the ocean, they are a feedback to a warming world. They are a feedback to increased CO2 concentrations, and they do, in general, draw down carbon and deposit it at the bottom of the ocean. And we have had these in the past, and most of the time they coincided with spikes in CO2, so with greenhouse worlds, and many times they also coincided with mass extinction.
Tracking the Climate Challenge, Radio EcoShock at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Sabine Lenger from the University of Plymouth. And it's interesting, Sabine, I interviewed the Russian plankton scientist Sergei Petrovsky. He's in England now, and he said science is not yet sure on whether plankton will increase or decrease with global warming. Do we really know what to expect with this other form of bacterial life as the planet shifts towards a greenhouse world?
That is a good question, and we're not really very sure what's going to happen to the bacteria that live in the ocean. So that is it's obviously very difficult to forecast, but it basically depends on the amount of nutrient concentrations that are available. As they eat ammonia, it'll obviously make some sense for them to be a bit more sensitive to ammonia concentration, for example. And they are sensitive to oxygen. So if we decrease oxygen concentrations, they can increase in abundance, for example. So, yes, that is very difficult to forecast, but we are trying.
And then we have another type of marine bacteria that I've read about that don't need oxygen, but those ones produce the toxic gas hydrogen sulfide as a byproduct. Paleoclimatologist Peter Ward wrote about it in his book Under a Green Sky, and he talked about how that form of life might have sent clouds of deadly gases over the continents. How do those kind of sulfur-based bacteria relate to the ones that you studied?
So basically, I don't know, if you look at the biogeochemistry of the oceans, of the biology of the ocean, then there's a number of chemicals that are used in order to eat organic matter, and oxygen is the most energy-efficient one, so that's why all the life tries to use oxygen if they can. If the oxygen is not present, there's all types of other compounds that can be used in order to eat organic matter, basically. And those bacteria that you were talking about, they take the oxygen from sulfate, which is very abundant in the ocean because it is a salt, so that's kind of, the ocean is quite sulfate-rich. They take the oxygen out of this and use it basically to oxidize the organic matter to CO2, and that's how they get their energy. But at the same time, they basically produce this H2S. So Anammox bacteria and these sulfate-reducing bacteria, usually they don't usually coincide very much, so they have slightly different niches. And in these oxygen-laden zones, or the dead zones that I was working in, these sulfate-reducing bacteria, they're actually not that abundant. But if you look at other areas, for example, the Black Sea, these are really, really abundant. And what's really interesting is that in previous dead zones in the oceans, if you look at the geological past, then these were also very, very abundant in many of them. And often, when they were really abundant, this was also related to mass extinction events. So we're not quite sure whether these dead zones that we have at the moment, these open ocean dead zones, can be developed into these zones that have the sulfur, hydrogen sulfide present in very high concentrations. But it's not quite well known how kind of to get this. So there's biogeochemical models that are trying to work on this and trying to predict whether this might be the case. But in principle, with Anammox bacteria, they're not really working together, if that makes sense.
It does. So if this chain of ocean deadening begins with large amounts of algae, could seeding plankton with iron as geoengineering disrupt normal oxygen levels in the sea, or even lead to a change in the most successful organisms?
Yes, I think so. I don't think the seeding experiments are a very good idea in general. I mean, I don't know how thoroughly they have been studied, but if you start seeding the ocean with more nutrients, and you will get an increased production. Wherever you get increased production, you will get increased remineralization of organic matter, and remineralization of organic matter uses up oxygen. So it depends on where this is being done, but if this is in any place where it probably depends, yeah, on how much kind of oxygen is delivered through other processes, but there's always the risk of when you increase primary production or carbon fixation, then this will also lead to oxygen depletion. This is a bit similar. I don't know if you have a pond or if you live near a lake. In the summer, when primary production is high, there's many lakes that tip over into eutrophic lakes. So eutrophication as a process, and that has to do with temperature, that has to do with runoff and nutrients that are in these lakes. But whenever you get a lot of algae growing on top of a body of water, you risk creating anoxic conditions underneath.
What are the priority things we need to know from your point of view, Sabine?
Well, about dead zones, it's kind of quite interesting because it's a very complex issue and you can't really solve the dead zone itself. What you need to solve is the problems around it. So we need to solve the problems into agriculture. So we need a sustainable agriculture. For example, the Gulf of Mexico dead zone is caused by runoff from the Mississippi into the Gulf of Mexico. And the heavy fertilization on the agriculture kind of along this river system. And a lot of this is, for example, caused by cash crops that are being used to produce biofuels, so for example, corn. So agriculture is one problem we need to solve. The other problem is just climate change itself. So if we do not manage to decrease CO2 emissions, greenhouse effect and the global temperature increase, then we can't really fix the dead zones either, because they will just develop as such, and we can't really change anything about that. So the root of the problem around the dead zone is actually found quite in a very complex and a networked system. For me personally, I think it's quite important to understand how these dead zones will respond in the future, and that also that we understand actually how the biogeochemistry works. Because at the moment, we can't really model the carbon cycle in these dead zones very well. So what I would find quite important is to do more research on the microbes that live there, what they do, and what kind of the amount of carbon fixation is that they do, what the amount of heterotrophic fixation is that they do. That can be done by many different approaches, and the best thing to do that is tackle this by using loads of different approaches like molecular biology, genomics, transcriptomics or proteomics probably, and then I think I can contribute to this by using this approach using biomarkers and chemicals that can help tell you about the signature of the organic material produced.
From the UK, we've been talking with chemistry lecturer Dr. Sabine Lenger, University of Plymouth. I will put links to this new science and a few helpful articles about it in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Sabine, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.